This episode is brought to you by Set for Life Insurance. Listen, docs, one of the first steps we took to pay off our student loan debt was realizing we paid way too much for our disability insurance. That all changed when we found Set for Life Insurance. They helped us with a customized insurance policy that met our needs and, most of all, budget. To learn more, check out setforlifeinsurance.com. This episode is brought to you by Physician CEO. Finally, a business program for busy doctors just like you. Get the skills of branding, marketing, entrepreneurship, and combine those with your gifts as a physician. Be known as a doc outside the box and define your future. Learn more at physician-ceo.com/DOTB.
Welcome to Docs Outside the Box Podcast. This is your official show, looking inside the minds of cutting edge and innovative doctors. Think you'll find these stories in any medical textbook? Sorry. You're getting real life insight from men and women pushing the envelope beyond medicine. Ordinary doctors doing extraordinary things. Let's start now with your host, Dr. Nee Darko.
What's good, everyone? Let me take y'all down memory lane for a quick second. So prior to medical school, I would take these odd jobs in the summertime and even sometimes during the year. But the jobs that I would take during the summertime were these like sales type jobs. Y'all know what I'm talking about. Either some of y'all worked at the Gap, Aeropostale, or what have you. But I would work at Sports Authority, and I'm not even sure if that still exists. And I would also times work at CompUSA. And I know for a fact CompUSA doesn't exist anymore, but I couldn't stand those jobs. I hated my bosses. I wasn't a big fan of my colleagues. It's just a different mindset, you know. But I remember coming home and letting my parents know about these things. And my parents would always just say, specifically my mom would say, you can't leave a job too early. Otherwise, it's going to look bad on your resume. So, you know, I stuck it out. It was the summertime, you know, a couple of months. And you kind of just move on with your life and go back to the semester and move on. You know, but you fast forward for me almost 20 years now, and that mindset still is in my mind, right? I always have in my mind that you really don't want to leave a place too early. Otherwise, it'll look bad on your resume, which for us now, it's no longer a resume, it's a CV. But, you know, because I'm an independent contractor now, I'm a locums. Like, if I don't like a place, if I don't get along with people, if I don't like administration, if I don't like the way how the quote unquote geopolitical things are going down at a certain hospital, I just don't return. And it's not really a quit. It's just, I ain't returning, you know, chuck the deuces, I ain't coming back, right? But for many others, a lot of you all don't have that ability. So you stick it out. And no matter how much you may feel that you're devalued, you may feel uninspired, or you just give zero Fs about your job, you stick it out. And I definitely applaud you on that. And that's something that's been ingrained in us for a really long period. But my next guest is challenging all of that. And she's saying that quitting strategically might be the path to happiness we've all been searching for. My next guest is Dr. Lynn Marie Morsky, and she calls herself a quote-unquote quitting evangelist. She helps people quit the right way through her book called Quitting by Design, as well as through her podcast, which I encourage you all to be subscribing to right now. It is called Quit Happens. She's a board-certified physician in family medicine as well as sports medicine and currently is working at the Veterans Administration. Scratch that. She does not work there anymore. So from the time I interviewed her earlier this year to now, she no longer works there. So yet another thing that she has quit. But not only is she a physician, not only is she a podcaster and author, she's also an attorney. She is former adjunct law professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. And when she's not doctoring, when she's not lawyering, she is preaching the gospel of strategic quitting. So I have her on this show to not just talk about quitting strategically, but also to tell her story about not wanting to do things by the book and how she's been able to quit through her own experiences and has led her to be as happy as she can right now. So things that you are going to learn in this episode, you're going to learn how to make your resume, your CV look good with multiple experiences in quitting. She's going to talk about how doctors can get over the stigma of quote unquote quitting their profession. What is diversification of identity? This is really important. Why she became a quitting evangelist also. And she's going to take us through the steps of quitting strategically as a physician. And as always, like all of my guests in the past, she's going to let us know hashtag how she's not just a doc. This is a good one. Make sure you share this with others. And without further ado, I present Dr. Lynn Marie Morsky. Physician, attorney, and lifelong quitting enthusiast, I have Dr. Lynn Marie Morsky from the Quit Happens podcast. Welcome to Docs Outside the Box. What's good? What's up?
Thank you so much for having me. I am so excited to be here.
And I'm excited to get you on here. I know we went back and forth a little bit on the dates and trying to make it happen, but you're finally here. I'm glad you're here. Let's make this happen. Let's talk about how you can make quitting very strategic and as well an opportunity to really advance, I guess, your life as well as your career.
Yes, indeed. Let's do it.
So look, before we get so much into specifically quitting your book, your podcast, let's take it back to like the fifth grade or sixth grade. Let's learn about Lynn Marie, who she was. From what I hear, you know, you weren't the typical person who, as soon as you were born, you wanted to be a doctor. Like, this is kind of like a circuitous path. Let's learn more about that.
Correct. Yeah. Fifth or sixth grade, I think I wanted to be a sports broadcaster. I stuck with the broadcasting theme all the way through high school. And I got into college and I went to a kind of broadcasting-ish school. I was a broadcast journalism major for maybe a month and a half. And one of my first quits. And I ended up graduating. It didn't take me long. Again, quitting is my superpower. You'll figure that out by the end of the episode. But I realized, okay, there's some things about broadcast journalism I don't want to do. I don't want to ever have to stick a microphone in somebody's face and ask them odd questions. So I went behind the scenes and ended up majoring in what was essentially video editing and video production.
Mm. What was it in the fifth grade or sixth grade that like attracted you to becoming a broadcaster? Because at that age, all you're seeing is people on TV, right? And Yes. They're putting their microphone in front of people and they're, you know, in front of the locker rooms. What was it that attracted you?
Well, I had the idea I was going to be the anchor person. They were just reading the news. So I had done acting from a like 11-year-old age. So fifth and sixth grade is when I first did my first professional theater. And so acting didn't seem like a secure enough gig, but somehow sitting at a desk and kind of acting, which is like reading the news, seemed easier, more secure. And that's what I was around. Like my parents and I would watch the news every night. That's just kind of like the authorities to me. And I thought, oh, I can read it.
No, not anymore. It's fake news now.
So. Right. Oh, totally fake news. I am old. Different generation. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you get all the way to college, right? And you're deciding, okay, you don't want to be in front of TV, but I'm assuming you want to be dealing with like the editing and the videography.
Yeah. I decided this was another stroke of genius that was terrible, is I was going to become a music video editor. Now, I was in St. Louis, Missouri. I don't know, besides Nelly, anybody who's making videos.
I was about to say, like, what year is this? Because I know, because you remember back, if we're around the same age, music videos like really blew up on MTV and BET. So I could see why you were kind of attracted. St. Louis, Nellyville, you know.
I lived in Nellyville. I'm from Blue and I'm proud. And unfortunately, I don't even know if Nelly makes his music videos in St. Louis. Like, this was not a thing I was going to be able to do in St. Louis. And, you know, from where I'm from, a small town in Southern Illinois, you didn't just necessarily up and move to Los Angeles to pursue your video editing dreams. That sounded frightening to me. And so at the end of school, I was like, oh my gosh, there's no video editing jobs. And I ended up just luckily the internship I had said, I had a video internship and they said, okay, if you can learn multimedia in a few weeks, you can work here as a multimedia designer. And I was like, all right, I'll learn multimedia. And so my first real job out of college was doing something that I kind of fell into and wasn't great at it, didn't have a lot of training. And so I jumped into grad school for multimedia thinking like, okay, this is where I'm going to learn how to be good at this thing I'm already employed to do. And that's where the quitting started because grad school wasn't helping me. I needed to take some courses outside of grad school to be good at multimedia. And then right at that same time is when it went from, okay, you can know HTML and you're good at multimedia to like, you need Java and C++ and all these things. And again, I had been like a broadcast journalism video editing person. I was not a coder. I didn't want to be a coder. The job changed so dramatically that I was like, they were hiring people over me and I'm seeing the writing on the wall. Like, I'm not going to be employable in this field and I'm miserable. We need to make some changes.
Mm. Okay. So the one thing that I found really fascinating about what you said is it sounded at this point now you're going to school, not for degrees, but just for skills, right? You went to school for degrees, right? And then you kind of figured out the skills later on. So that was pretty interesting that you were at that point. So like, let's fast forward, I guess, I don't know, a couple years later, what happened next? And then how did you pivot into medicine? Well, how did even medicine get involved?
Yeah. So there are a few things that happened simultaneously around the time that I realized that this wasn't going to work out. Somewhere around there, my brother called me and informed me like, hey, do you know that I don't think our parents have like a big retirement fund or maybe any. My dad had worked for himself forever and my mom had been taking care of her mom who had had a stroke. And He's like, I'm working at the Westin. You're working in a job that clearly you're not that good at and making no money at. We like, need thanks, to do bro. Something. Thank yeah. Well, the wake up call was necessary. I mean, he did start with, hey, I'm working at the Westin. You know, so like neither of us were on the road to financial freedom anytime soon. And so then that like got it in my head, like, he's right. This job's going nowhere. We need to do something. And I also was a kind of quasi-competitive swing dancer at the time. And my swing dance partner, I love your face. Nobody can see me's face but me, but it's great.
But swing dancing, all right.
Swing dancing, yeah. I've done it all. So my swing dance partner was a urology resident. His name is Dr. John Lin, that people in our mutual groups will definitely know. He's all over the Facebook doctor groups. And he was working one night on call. And I thought, like, I'm going to be nice. I'm just going to just deliver him some food. So I go over to the ER where he was, I think he must have been in an internship because he was doing stuff that wasn't urology yet. But he meets me in the ER and he's like, if you don't think you'll pass out, you can come back and watch me put in this chest tube. And I had never thought about doing that.
He definitely was an intern then. Yeah. If he's doing,
yeah, if he's doing chest tubes, right?
Right.
And so I'd like, it's not a thing I had ever thought about. I mean, never. I had never thought about being a doctor, even though I was like one of the smart kids. And everybody else, maybe on the smart kid track, would have thought about that. Did not cross my mind. I thought blood was gross. Not going to happen. And so I went back and I watched him put in this chest tube. And I distinctly remember as he puts it in, I was like, I can do this. Like, because I was at this
period. Oh, so you weren't even grossed out.
I wasn't grossed out. No. Wow. But I was at this period where I had just opened my mind to absolutely any possibility. I knew it wasn't going to be multimedia or probably not video editing. Could I be a florist, a dog walker? Like, I had said, okay, anything. Let's just be very open. And when I realized I could sit through that, I was like, okay, I could do this. This is definitely on the list. I decided, okay, well, I've made a quote unquote mistake already once going down one path. I better know what I'm getting into if I'm going to stop and try to do medicine. Medicine is a much more lengthy and expensive path.
You're talking about 10 years of investing, yeah?
10 years and $250,000. So I thought, okay, I'm going to shadow everybody that I can. Like, I'm going to figure out what specialty, because I was not going to be one of these people who went into medicine not knowing what specialty. That was like too much of a crapshoot. I'd already, again, picked one career I wasn't great at. I didn't want to go into medicine assuming I was going to like something and then not. And out of
But hold on. Like, you are literally shadowing because you want to know if medicine is for you, but mainly because financially, you need the dough.
Well, I need the dough. There were other things about medicine that I like. For example, in multimedia, I did love the problem solving, but what I didn't love is that when like I get the blue screen of death, the computer couldn't tell me what I had done wrong in the programming. And I thought, oh, patients can at least tell me what's wrong with them, which is comical because at this point I'm like, please stop telling me what's wrong
with me. That's what to say. Be careful what you ask for.
Exactly. That's the whole thing about anybody who has any quote unquote regret of their decisions. Take that regret away because you cannot know what it's like until you try it. You know, it sounded very romantic. I am patient. I have A, B, and C symptoms. Here, figure me out. That is not how it rolls. They're going to tell you about their parrot for 20 minutes, and then maybe you'll get a symptom or two out of them, and you've got to figure it out. Like, you don't know until you've tried, right? But I thought I liked the detective aspect of medicine, and I was around people that were so respectful of doctors, you know, whether or not they earned it. And I was in this relationship with this doctor, and I told somebody at work I was going to break it off. They're like, but he's a doctor. And I was like, I'm going to be my own doctor. Like, I'm tired of somebody, you know, like being told, oh, you should just settle for whatever. If this person's a doctor, I was like, this doesn't make sense in my world. I'm going to go do this thing myself. And so I remember calling my dad and I was like, I've decided what career I want. Well, actually, I'd called him initially and saying, like, I don't think I want to do multimedia anymore. And he has worked for his family business for his whole life. And he said, please find something you like. Do not be miserable your whole life doing something you hate, essentially kind of like Cuba. I said, well, I'm put lots of things on the table. And he said, well, I always thought you'd be a doctor or a lawyer.
Mm.
Yeah. And so,
you got the permission of the dad.
Well, didn't need it, but essentially, like, that was just his thought. Like, essentially, like, I never saw you in broadcasting. I thought you'd be a doctor or a lawyer. Again, just because that's what you think smart people are going to do, right? So when I called him back after doing all this shadowing and figuring out, this is the part I left out, I figured out the only thing I wanted to do in medicine, the only thing that sounded interesting was sports medicine, which if you know anything about primary care sports medicine, is essentially the least medical thing you could be doing. You're mostly giving out ice and rest, you know, to healthy people. It's not terribly medical, but that's what I decided because I was a dancer and I thought, well, that's, you could do dance medicine with sports medicine, right? So I call my dad back and I say, all right, I've decided what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a doctor. And he goes, I meant lawyer. I was like, what? And he said, you can't handle blood. I said, well, I can't handle my own blood, but like, I don't plan to cut myself open. Like, I don't think other people's going to be as bad. So then I had to do pre-med over. I didn't have any pre-med classes. I had to start from scratch at age like 21. I quit grad school halfway through. That was another big quit. And then I did pre-med.
That's quit number two now. I'm keeping track.
Quit number two and did pre-med, med school, got a residency at Mayo Clinic, Arizona, and then got a fellowship at the U of A doing sports medicine.
Wow. How long did I take that pre-med, getting the prerequisites and so forth before you actually applied? Tell us how long that took.
Well, I got very lucky, and there was a program at my local chiropractic college that was a pre-med accelerated program where you could do all of pre-med in a year, right?
Again,
knees face is amazing. Yeah, all of pre-med in a year, all of the science, right? And so I happened to call our St. Louis University, which was the only medical school that was near me or that was nearest to me that I thought I had a chance at. And I just said to their admissions department, I was like, would you accept these credits from this chiropractic college? And miraculously, they like wrote back and said everything but the biology. So every day I would drive to the chiropractic school on one side of St. Louis, take these pre-med courses all day, drive to another school, University of Missouri, St. Louis, take biology at night. And then after that, drive to a coffee shop and start studying for the MCAT. I did that all in a year.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
And obviously you did good enough that you got into school. So
indeed. Yes. I got into just St. Louis University.
Did you just apply to St. Louis University?
I applied to 30, my friends. Oh, okay. I got into one.
Wow. Wow. That's a really interesting story. So let's fast forward. Like you said, you got into Mayo for residency. Now you did residency in family medicine?
Yes.
Family medicine. And then obviously sports medicine. So during this time, any thoughts of this is not what I really thought it was going to be, or was it still just kind of easy peasy? This is what I expected.
Oh yeah. Never easy peasy. Not for a second. I'd gone from being like high school valedictorian, college, I had like a 3.97 to med school. I was like, oh, can somebody else check my grades for me? Like, I'm not even sure I passed. Like, I was so not in the right situation. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was the first time I'd been around so many other super high achievers, but it was kind of a constant struggle. I ended up doing fine academically, but we're in the rotation period, you know, third and fourth year. And I'm going rotation to rotation, and I do not like any of them because I keep saying to myself,
not even family.
Oh, no, no, no. Family was just a route to sports medicine because sports medicine is only a fellowship.
No, I get it.
You had to do peds, ER, PM&R, or family generally to get to primary care sports medicine fellowship. And those are my only four options. And I was like, I don't like kids. I'm not doing peds. I can't handle like emergencies. So I don't want to do that. And then PM&R was just like too much stroke stuff that it left family. And yeah, didn't like my family rotation, didn't like any rotation. And I thought once I get to sports medicine, I will like that one. You know, I think I had like one sports medicine month. And everybody else in my med school class, you'd ask them like, hey, what are you going to do for a residency? And like so many of them would say, I don't know. I love all the rotations. And I was like, what's wrong with you? And I should have been like, what's wrong with me? What have I done wrong? But again, when you're in a situation, and this is why I want people to have compassion for themselves again, if they've made a decision that they later think back on, not fondly, is that, you know, I had my head down, light at the end of the tunnel thing because I had to. Like, we had to make some money for the family or have some stable income between my brother and I. I had been raised not in a wealthy family, and I was not going to live like that for the rest of my life. And I saw that was the path I was going down in multimedia, making no money. And I also wanted out of St. Louis. Like, medicine's a really great way to, when you do the match, you can get out of wherever you are. So there were so many external factors that kept me from ever looking up and looking around and reevaluating and saying, is this the right move? And especially once you're in med school and you're already a quarter million in, it is really difficult to say, like, am I doing the right thing? But it was literally like a complete struggle all the time. And then it just got worse when I got to residency because we're Q3. Mayo is very strict. You have to wear a suit every day. And they have the way that the Mayo brothers do things. And it's very like not outside the box. You do it their way, which is not my jam. I was just simply miserable for 3 years, just thinking, come on, like hold on till the day I can get the sports medicine fellowship.
Now at that point though, any regrets, any, like, you know how they say you jump from one frying pan into, I forget what the terminology is, but did you feel like that? Like you weren't really happy with where things were going with a multimedia standpoint. And now you're jumped into something where you got a lot of debt, you spent a lot of time. And although the income would be okay, you're not happy. Like, how did you make that match? How did that work?
Because this entire, let's say 9 years, until the last year when I finally did get to the sports medicine fellowship, the entire 9 years, I continued to operate under the belief that sports medicine was this panacea of awesome. Mm. Everything was going to be amazing once I got there. Despite the fact that the writing was on the wall from day one, like, okay, if you don't like any rotations, sports medicine is going to be at least a little bit like some of these rotations, right? Like there are patients involved either way, right? And that's why, you know, we'll get to what I do later, but that's why I'm so passionate about what I do and especially sharing my message with doctors, because we are so often in that situation where, like, once we're in, we either just look at that light at the end of the tunnel and we don't reevaluate and we get there and we're like, oh my God, or, you know, halfway through the tunnel, we do reevaluate, but we're like, oh my gosh, I've already spent so much time and money. So there's just so much weight in everything that we do. So the entire time, I mean, we're talking like when I was Q3, I remember crying at the drop of a hat. I was just like, you just can't function like that for very long. I was anxious all the time. By fellowship, I was giving myself beta blockers just to be able to stay in clinic.
I heard about this. Let's talk about it. So you were self-medicating. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So you thought you had tachycardia.
No, I did have tachycardia, only induced by having to see clinic patients every 15 minutes.
But you didn't put it together that this tachycardia was due to anxiety, actually.
Exactly.
So you started treating with, what did you say, low pressor?
Just propranolol.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I mean, I had had a panic attack in anatomy. Like, I started having palpitations back in anatomy first year, and I went to the ER, and nobody said, hey, are you anxious? They just said, they did the normal, like, oh, your heart's fine. Nobody was like, maybe are you totally miserable in studying medicine? Like, nobody flagged that. And so I get another 9 years down the road and I'm treating myself with beta blockers, trying to get my heart to slow down. Finally, I was like, oh my God, it's not my heart. It's my like brain that can't handle doing this thing.
Did you talk to anybody about this? Like your classmates, your fellow residents, attendings? Did you mention any of this to anybody?
Well, my dislike for doing traditional medicine traditionally started flaring up, let's say, if it's a condition, when I was at Mayo. That caused a lot of friction because there were some people that were so by the book. And then I had one residency director who, Dr. Edwards, God bless him, ended up writing me a note like, hey, something about like, you're a little different. It's okay. Like, because I was just kind of distraught all the time there because I, you know, I would do things the way that I thought they were best and nobody else liked that, or I definitely didn't want to deliver babies or whatever else everybody else wanted to do. I think you could just tell, and a lot of people could just tell. I mean, I had a countdown. It became kind of comical. I had a countdown to the end of residency starting like 100 days before the end of residency, like a little physical, like stay 99. Like, obviously I'm miserable. Everybody knew it. I didn't even have to tell anybody. And it was mostly just a situation of like, can you even get through this? Because you're clearly like halfway unraveling, but nobody said like, would you like to see a therapist? Mm. Nobody said that. Not a thing. It was essentially just like, is there something wrong with you because you shouldn't be here? I mean, my residency class of 6 people lost 3 people by the end of the first year. So the residency was that tough.
Which is uncommon for family medicine, right?
Yeah, it was just, I mean, and that residency has closed. It's gone.
Okay. Let me ask you this question and let's fast forward into sports medicine fellowship. Yeah. Was it the panacea?
No.
And so it got worse or?
Things that are worse are not that, like, I no longer am I Q3 and nobody from Mayo is there. And I loved everybody at the University of Arizona. Like, they were amazing, amazing people. But first off,
like the mecca of sports. I mean, like, you got the Wildcats there from, you know, basketball. I mean, I remember growing up, you wanted to play, you know, my favorite team besides the Georgetown Hoyas was University of Arizona basketball team. Their track team was the bomb. The football team was the bomb. Like, this is the place you want to be.
Yeah, if you like sports. And that is a crucial portion that I had kind of missed in the entire thing.
So wait, you didn't like sports?
I don't like sports. Right? Like, there is so many.
This is so fascinating, but keep going. I'm loving this. I love it.
Because again, you can concoct something in your head that you think is going to be true. And what I had said to myself is sports medicine is the most like dance medicine. And I had even talked to the people at the University of Arizona saying, hey, you have a great dance program. I realized, yes, technically this is sports medicine. I'm going to have to work for the football team and all this stuff. But can I spend some time with the dance medicine department? Because that's what I really want to do. And they were like, absolutely. But in reality, that didn't ever happen. So it was essentially spending 7 hours. And I'm going to describe everybody else's dream job right now. Like, I would spend 7 hours at the football game, you know, 2 hours beforehand, hanging out with the docs and the players, where they're all talking about whatever sport ball thing they've watched all day, where I have definitely not been sitting in front of a TV watching anything. I have no idea what they're talking about. And then I stand on the sidelines of a game I don't understand, so much so that I had to have somebody show me with like Madden football how it worked so that I wouldn't accidentally cheer at the wrong times and that would be caught on ESPN. And then afterward, you have to hang out for another 2 hours and like sew up the players and the cheerleaders. And then the next day, you'd have to come in and check on their concussions. And then the next day, you'd have to, like, there was no downtime. I didn't realize, oh, sports medicine happens on night and weekends, but you're already going to be working all day in a clinic. So there's no free time. And I do not live to work. I work to live. And so I was like, oh boy, I have no free time. And 100% of my time is spending feeling like a total fraud on the sidelines of these games I don't understand, trying really hard to look interested. So I knew pretty early on, like, oh, this is not happening.
So what did you end up doing? You know, at the sports medicine fellowship is what, an additional 3 years?
No, it's one.
1 year, excuse me, I'm sorry. 1 year. What did you end up doing? Like, let's,
yeah.
What started this whole process of, I guess, quitting then by design?
Yeah. So I went to my fellowship director and I told him that I was unhappy. But again, you know, I thought, okay, I'm already here. It's not to where my health is dying. Like, I clearly, at some point in time, somebody should have sent me to a therapist. That never happened. I didn't tell him I was taking beta blockers, I don't think, but I just told him, okay, sports medicine is not for me. And so he was so kind because, like, then the U of A got into some tournament that happens in Las Vegas and everybody was so excited they get to travel. And he said, you don't have to go. We'll send somebody else. Great. Like, they started letting other people do the football games for me. Like, they just started taking away responsibilities, which was great. They were just sent to just kind of like finish. Like, it looks kind of bad for them if I don't finish too, you know? So they were really invested in my health and their own, and like, let's everybody make this work some way. So I ended up finishing that out. But at that point, then I made a no list of things I'm not going to do again. I do not want to be on call. I do not want to have a pager. I do not want to write prescriptions because I was moonlighting in an urgent care and I saw the opioid stuff happening. And I was like, I do not want to do that. And I do not want to work for high maintenance patients who have emergencies that aren't emergencies. And I literally, what I did after fellowship is I took a job in an urgent care, or I just kept moonlighting, and said, okay, this pays the bills. I'm working, you know, maybe 5 shifts a month. And I'm going to do this until I find a job that has nothing on my no list and only things on the tolerable list. And the first thing I did is I went to try to find work in an EMR company because I love the EMR. That was my favorite part of medicine. Everybody else's least favorite part. I loved it. And so I actually got a job from McKesson. The only reason I didn't take it, I was offered the job, is that it was 90% travel. And I was like, oh, I don't want to travel that much. And so I just kept moonlighting and I found the job that I currently still have. I found it on Twitter 10 years ago.
And the job is?
I do compensation and pension exams for the VA, 10 hours a week here in San Diego. I started in Phoenix and then I came out to San Diego, same job.
But I'm a bad, ain't too shabby.
No. I'm living the dream, at least in
shabby.
Very many aspects. But yeah, I found that job on Twitter and it was like, do exams. There's no call. You make your own schedule. You don't get paid if the patient doesn't show and you get no benefits. If you take a day off, you're getting nothing. However, there was the freedom of making your own schedule and then there's no continuity. Like, you left, nobody was going to call you at home. There's no pager and you don't have to write any prescriptions. And I was like, amazing. This is exactly as medical as I want to be.
Wow. So that was 10 years ago, you said?
That was, yeah, I started at the VA 9 years ago.
Wow.
And now a word from our sponsor. Meet Dr. Arthur Cummings. He's a busy ophthalmologist practicing all the way in Dublin, Ireland. Recently, he finished Physician CEO. Check out what got him to jump on the transatlantic flight to participate in this program.
My initial response would simply be, just do it. This is one of those programs that is so good, it's very likely to be the best education you've ever received. And you realize then as a physician how little we really know about our businesses, even though we're running businesses that are quite large. And the level of training is so fantastic. The education is so good. The faculty is immaculate, and you're in a group of people who are like-minded. So just the entire environment is an amazing learning experience and really a good incubator for growing your practice.
So if you're a physician who's looking to start your own venture or even lead your practice or department, then you can't afford to miss this opportunity. Class is filling up. Learn more at physician-ceo.com/DOTB.
So then how did you, let's talk about the podcast, you know, Quit Happens.
Like, when do we get to this part?
It's fascinating because I'd like to know, like, how did you decide that, okay, you know what, I'm going to start helping people on quitting. I'm going to start helping people to understand that, you know, you can quit, quote unquote, strategically. How did you stumble onto that, if you did, or was this by master plan?
Yeah, definitely stumbled. I don't think anybody's master plan is grow up and become a quitting evangelist. I don't think that's in the What Color Is My Parachute book. But after I got out of fellowship, I moved next to a law school, decided I really wanted to go there, did. So I got a law degree. I'm trying to speed this up for your poor audience.
All right, keep going. Let's keep going. So you had to go to law school.
Yeah, so I get my law degree. Wait, real quick.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Why? Why did you want to be a lawyer?
Oh, because I had studied how to take the LSAT back in grade school. And I thought back in that fifth, sixth grade time, I had to read a book for an assignment. And my dad had a How to Take the LSAT book laying around. And so then I loved that book. And then I started tutoring. I tutored my brother on how to take the LSAT. I tutored my salsa partner on how to take the LSAT. And like when I moved next to a law school, there was just feeling like, oh my God, so jealous that those guys get to take the LSAT and they get to like study law. And I just thought to myself, if I can go there for free, because I'm clearly already so in debt, if I can go there for free, like, and I'm only working 10 hours a week, I totally want to go there. And I made that decision in August. And by January, I was in law school.
Wow.
That's how that happened.
Okay. So you did that for 3 years?
Did that for 4 years because I was part-time. Then at law school graduation, I gave a speech on quitting. That was the first time I ever mentioned it. So I thought, what can I talk to the graduates about that nobody talks about that will still be very helpful? And so I told them how strategic quitting had gotten me from being a multimedia designer in St. Louis, Missouri, to being a doctor lawyer in San Diego. And it was well received. Some other podcast picked it up and I did that as a thing. So pause on that. After law school, I joined a startup. I'm still working at the VA this entire time, 2 days a week, but I joined a startup up in Venice Beach as the co-founder.
Still a nice place. That ain't too shabby either.
Oh yeah. I don't move to shabby places.
It's beautiful. Excuse me.
Yes. Wow. So I was chief medical officer, in-house legal counsel, and co-founder of this startup. And I did that for a year. And that started causing some major, major health problems because I was living in Venice Beach, driving back and forth to San Diego, trying to practice medicine and keep the startup going. And that was another huge quit that I learned through. And then after that, I thought, I want to teach law. So I taught law for a few semesters. That was not my jam. And so after all this, to the climax that you're finally going for, is that one day I am just taking a bath and I'm listening to Tim Ferriss' podcast. He has Seth Godin on. And they were talking about finding your calling. And I was like, I'm 38. It is about time I found my calling. I had just been a delegate to the Democratic National Convention. I'm like, I've dabbled in so many things. Nothing gets me up in the morning. I want to be one of those people that like is excited to wake up in the morning and do what they get to do. And so the podcast suggested, ask your friends what your calling is. Maybe they have a better idea. So I put a thing on Facebook like, hey guys, what do you think I should be doing? Gave him some options. And one literally said to me like, I'll meet up with you. Let's talk about it. And so I'm waiting for him in a parking lot of Starbucks. And I got out my little journal. And on one side of the page, I wrote things I'm good at. And the other side, I wrote what I like to do. And under what I like to do was public speaking and giving advice. And when I put pen to paper on the side of the what I'm good at, what came out was quitting. And I just thought, I'm going to make this happen. Somehow I'm going to combine what I love to do and what I'm good at and like spread the message of strategic quitting.
What I want to know is, how are you able to justify quitting strategically versus, you know, how it looks on like a CV or how it looks like on a resume? Like, how do you make that work for you going from job to job or position to position? How do you make it become a positive as opposed to a detriment?
I think it's all in the way you frame it and all in the person who's looking at it next, right? And frankly, I think it can be a fantastic litmus test. I hate to use that cliche term, but if you have a resume that has a few things on it that are like, say, less than a year, which might be what would flag people, right? Because even, you know, recently I had a second job in politics in 2017. And there was a big part of me that was like, just stay for a year so that your LinkedIn says 1 year. And I didn't because it wasn't working out for me. The thing is, if you go to the next person and they're looking at your resume and they see these small things and they already thought you were a qualified candidate, but they're going to discount you because of these small things without asking you why they're there, you don't want to work for them.
Okay.
And if they ask you about them, you give them the most honest reason about you, not about what was wrong with the place, but about how, for some reason, it wasn't fitting with you. Okay, just my working style and the office setup there wasn't right. Like, just don't badmouth the company. Or, you know, if it's possible to say, like, I just really had an entrepreneurial spirit and I had grown as much as I could and learned as much as I could from that. And I felt very stagnant there. You know, it wasn't that there was anything bad about it. I just wasn't growing anymore. You know, find a way to spin it as best and as positively as possible. And if the person thinks you're a qualified candidate, they should understand that. They should also, in their own right, you know, they want to hire you and they want you to stay for a long time. But if you're 7 months in there and you're not working, they'd probably rather you move on. And that's the kind of person that you want to be working for.
Okay. So the thing that I want to know also is, you know, a lot of doctors and even medical students, like them becoming a resident is their first job or becoming an attending is their real, quote unquote, real job. So they've spent 5, 10, 13 years really focused on becoming a doctor. And now you're saying that actually the way to success, maybe even the way to really get to the point where you need to get, is to kind of have taste multiple things, right? What's the way in which you help people, particularly doctors, get over the stigma of quitting? What's the proof in the pudding? What's the sauce? I want to hear this.
Well, doctors have a lot of specific, there are a lot of doctor-specific reasons that make quitting harder for us. A big one is the fact that we have spent a lot of time and money getting to where we've gotten. And that's one hurdle to get over. And I'll talk about that in a second. Another big hurdle is that a lot of people fear if we're leaving clinical medicine, they fear that society is going to think that we're, you know, didn't you go in because you wanted to help people? Are you suddenly Satan's spawn because you don't want to help people anymore? Right.
Yeah. I've heard that a lot, actually.
Right. Right. That is a legit thing that you hear. And we'll talk about that. And then the third thing is, depending on what you're doing with your doctorness, like if you're going to go totally out of medicine, you may have that fear of like, well, my identity is as a doctor. well, who am I if I leave that?
I definitely have gone through that one.
Yeah, so right?
You got some stuff to unpack.
Yes. So those are the three big ones. And so starting with the first one, which is how much time or money you have spent. I consciously stopped before saying spent because you can view it as spent or you can view it as an investment. So I have the option to either see that 10 years that I spent and that $250,000 that I spent going from multimedia designer to sports med doctor as having spent time and money to get to sports medicine. That's a way to look at it that will make it a lot harder to leave. Better way to look at it that I advise is look at what I was doing when I was in multimedia was saying, I'm going to spend 10 years and $250,000 of somebody else's money to get to a career I love. I am investing in finding a career I love. I am not spending time and money to get to sports medicine, though at the time I thought it was, but I was investing in finding a career path that I enjoyed. And when I get to sports medicine and I don't love it, I owe it to myself because I've already invested so much to keep going until I find that. It's not a waste. I've spent 10 years gaining skills that I can now use in my, you know, in the job that pays the bills for now. But I owe it to myself to not say, oh, I got to stop right there. I spent all this time or money getting here. No, no, no. You have invested in trying to have a happy life with a happy career. You need to keep going. You've spent 10 years and all that money also finding out what you don't like and what you do like.
You know, but this is very similar to what the general public goes through though, right? Like they oftentimes they have a job and they've spent a long time going through that and they oftentimes have to make a career pivot. So, I mean, why should we be any different or immune to this?
Yeah, absolutely. It's mostly just that we've spent a little more time and a little more money, but you're absolutely right that they're now college is so expensive for everybody. Like at the time, college was not quite as expensive. And so med school was like crazy expensive. But yeah, now there are people who have, you know, $100,000 loans just from undergrad and the same thing is applying to them. So yeah, absolutely. Just see it as an investment that you're learning from because you were not handed a handbook in fifth grade or even at age 16 or 18 or whenever you're signing up for college that says, this is what you're going to like to do with your life. We do not know ourselves that well at 16. We have no idea if we're going to like working with people or not like working with people or like working with the elderly versus people. This is not a thing you grow up knowing, right? You have to try. You have to do trial and error. And error sounds terrible, but you know, trial and then try again. And so that's what I advise saying is I don't see that as time or money that's wasted. It is time or money you invested in learning and what you do and do not like to do, but it should not keep you handcuffed to that career. Continue to make that investment worth it by continuing to figure out what you want to do.
I wanted to ask about part three, actually, the part where you have your personality so much into becoming a doctor that you feel like if you walk away, like, who are you? Who am I? Like, I'm really interested in your thought process on it because I think a lot of people really suffer from that, right? They spend their entire life, at least their childhood and their early years, like, oh, I can't wait to be a doctor. That's who I'm going to be. And if you have any type of, you know, pothole or maybe it becomes so difficult, you maybe even tend not to talk about it, right? You become shy and so forth. I definitely go through that, right? As a trauma surgeon, like there was a point where I just felt like, you know, me being a trauma surgeon was who I was as a man also, you know, so I struggle with that. So I'm really interested to hear your thought process on that.
Well, there's two steps in there. You said something very important right at the end there. That's who I am as a man. If you're unpacking things in this personal development world that I'm in, that's your ego talking.
I feel like I feel like I'm on a couch now with you. Okay, let's do this.
This is awesome. But I mean, what is talking right there? That's just your ego talking. And when I say just, your ego is not just. Like your ego is what's running the show very often when things like that come up. Like who am I if people see me and they don't see me as a doctor, right? Who am I if I'm not providing in this certain way? And so there may be quits of mindsets that you have to go through first before you can make that quit. Quit the mindset of my job is my identity. My identity defines who I am. I won't be a man if I'm not doing this thing. For example, if you always grew up wanting to be a doctor, there's growing up wanting to be, okay, I have an MD, but there's also, did I grow up wanting to help people? And realizing there's 1,000 other ways you can help people. And if being a doctor isn't jiving with you and your values, you're probably not that great as a doctor. I mean, let's be honest, if you were miserable, I was not fantastic as a clinician who was treating people because I was having a hard time holding it together myself. So helping people in the way that I do now, I'm significantly more helpful because I'm so passionate about it. So if you wanted to grow up being a helper, then you still have that as your identity. The honest truth is, if we'd committed 1,000 malpractices, we'd still have a medical degree, right? We are still doctors. You can get your license taken away. You can go to jail like Michael Jackson's doctor. You are still a doctor and they can't take that away. So if your fear is that you're at a cocktail party and somebody says, what do you do? And you're like, I'm a woodworker. You can still work in at some point in the conversation if you're really dying to let somebody know that you got a medical degree.
To use.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I was a doctor, actually, but that wasn't working for me. And then I went into woodworking. Do you know how much more fascinating you are at that point that you've left medicine? Like, that takes so much courage. It's like they have one respect for you that you made it to medicine and a whole nother respect that you like walked away and you're like, I want to do this creative thing on the side. And another thing, I'm just ranting at this point because this is like my favorite topic, but another thing about this whole identity piece is what Tim Ferriss calls diversification of identity. And most doctors, we already have a diverse identity because most of us are like polymaths and whatever that word is, multi-potentialites. Like we're into so many things, right? You and I are like doctor podcasters. I'm also a musician and a dancer. And like other people are going to do woodworking or surfing or like they're doctors or they're husbands or they happen to be wives or maybe they're uncles. Like we're not one thing. Like if you look at Barack Obama's Twitter account, look at what it says, like right under where it says Barack Obama. It says like husband, father, president, environmentalist or something. I mean, there's a fourth thing. I forget the fourth thing. But like that's his identity. When he stopped being president, he wasn't suddenly nothing, right? I'm still a husband, still a father, still an environmentalist.
That's a good point.
Yeah, you're never just one thing. And if for some reason you are, you think doctoring is all I have, find a hobby. Like figure out what else you love to do because that puts a lot of pressure on medicine being amazing if that's the only thing in your life, right?
Yeah. Now let's talk about your podcast, Quit Happens. I can't remember. Is the podcast came first or the book came first? The book came out in September.
Right. So the podcast, I only started, there was never a plan to do a podcast. And I can't believe that I hadn't because it's the best thing I do. But I wrote the book and I sent it to a publisher. Well, I got a publisher and we signed a contract in December of 2017. Then the next month I was like, what do I do while I'm waiting for this to come out? Let's start a podcast. Mm-hmm. So the podcast was somewhere in the waiting for the book to be published.
And the podcast, obviously Quit Happens. You're talking to various people. Most of the people aren't physicians, but it's still really fascinating. I find it really fascinating just the mindset of certain people. You know, which actually some of their mindsets, I think, are actually very similar to doctors, right? Like they were pushed into a certain field because of a certain family member or just, you know, whatever the certain ideas or stigmas of leaving that. And, you know, they've been able to kind of get through that. Can you talk more about your podcast, the type of experience, the people that you have on your show and what, you know, you hope people should get out of the show?
Absolutely. The two things I want people to get out of the show from these guests are the knowledge that number one, you are not alone. Whatever you are trying to quit, I am going to find somebody out there who has done it. For example, I've had people who quit when they were really, really good at a sport and then they were going to go to the pros and they didn't. I had somebody quit the Peace Corps. I've had people quit the Mormon
Church. Are you serious? Damn.
Yeah. What was crazy is that I, like, especially the girl who, she quit her family and quit the Mormon Church. I had asked her to come over.
Damn, Dr. Morrissey.
Yeah, we get real on this show. The comical thing about the first four episodes, episode number two, my second guest, I said, well, I know you quit social work. At this point, you know, when you start a podcast, you just ask your friends. And I was like, will you come over and talk about quitting social work? And she's like, I could actually talk about quitting my family in the Mormon Church. And I was like, yes, please. Like that's significantly more interesting. And that's what happened. Like the next guy, I was like, can you come talk about quitting the Science Center? He's like, I think I'd rather talk about quitting relationship expectations. I was like, sign me up. Like, so one person.
So it goes so much more deeper than what you expect, right?
Totally. So yeah, I still have people who come on and talk about quitting a job, but generally there's a mindset quit you had to make before quitting that job. You had to quit the mindset of everybody's judging me or everybody's going to judge me by my new job or by my old job, or this is a dream job and they're going to judge me if I leave it, or society says I should be doing this thing. They have to quit society's idea of success if they're going to scrap the job and start all over. And there are so many interesting quits. So what I want to do in the podcast is bring those quits to people. So it says like, no matter what you're thinking of quitting, I had somebody there that did divorce. You know, if you're thinking about quitting a thing, I have a podcast guest that you can pull up and listen to their story so that you feel less alone. That's number one. And number two is to get tips from those people on how they did it. Like, how did you get over the fear of going out on your own and doing an entrepreneurial thing? How'd you get over the fear of doing a divorce? Or how'd you get over the stigma of leaving the Peace Corps? Like all those kinds of things. I want to get those tips from people. Like, I don't know everything there is to be about every quit. And so let's have other people come on and tell their stories.
Well, let me ask you a question, Dr. Morsky. Is there a time when quitting is bad? Like you literally... Because I know you have clients also, and you obviously have the podcast, you wrote the book. Is there a time when you heard someone say, yeah, I quit, and you're like, ooh, I wouldn't have done that. Like, I think you would have said that to someone who wanted to quit, like the Peace Corps, right? Because like, you know, like, that's the greatest job, right? You're helping people who need help, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like,
I mean, aren't doctors helping people who need help?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Right? And she was in, I think it was Gambia, if I'm not quoting her wrong. And she got extremely physically ill. Also, it was in a culture where she didn't speak the language and nobody was talking to her and she didn't know what she was doing. And she has some like kind of some GI issues and they were just out of control. And so like her own health was suffering. So how much help could she give her community there? She couldn't. And she was just unraveling. And so anybody who's, you know, your health is of paramount importance, because if you are not healthy, you cannot help anybody else. So there are very few situations where I say don't quit. What I do say is quit strategically. Mm-hmm. So don't up and quit. And it's also different from giving up. Those are very different things on the quitting spectrum. I advocate strategic quitting.
Could you give us a little window into that? What does that mean?
A strategic quit is one that you have consciously thought about. So it doesn't come up one day and you're just like, oh, I'm having a bad day, I'm quitting. It's like you have realized the signs. Okay, my GI system is failing, or me and my tachycardia and my panic and my years of not liking medicine. Okay, all these signs point to this needs to go. That's step one. Step two is, what exactly needs to go? Like, I didn't say, okay, I'm never practicing medicine again. I said, no pager, no call. Like, these are the things I'm quitting about medicine. And some, if for surgeons, and maybe I'm going to quit doing this type of procedure, or I'm going to quit seeing this type of patient. Like, whatever is causing you the most friction and causing you the symptoms, quit only that. Don't make it harder than it has to. Step three is overcoming the mental fears, kind of the esoteric fears of what people would think or sunk costs if you have those fears. Step four is preparing your logistics. Make sure your finances are in order. This is a huge one. If I just up and quit today, oh my goodness, Fannie and Freddie or whoever now owns my $250,000 of loans, no matter how bankrupt I become, they are still going to come after me, right? I cannot just be a digital nomad making $5 a day. Like, I have to have an income. So I have to strategically continue to practice medicine 10 hours a week until something else, you know, supplants that entire salary. And in that same step, you got to prepare your finances. Sorry, you got to prepare your health, because quitting isn't always easy. So make sure you got your sleep in order, your health in order, your diet in order. And prepare your relationships. You know, if somebody else is involved, make sure they're on board. They can either be your biggest support or your biggest hindrance. And step five is making the quit in the way that burns the fewest bridges and preserves relationships as best as possible.
Boom. Damn. I love it. So, like, when you work with clients, like, what do you find is the most common theme among your clients?
I'd say, well, for the doctor clients, it's trying to replace that salary and the fear of, will the next thing replace that salary? That's a big thing. But, you know, I had somebody once just call me and say, I don't know how to actually make the quit. She's like, I've found another job. I know I don't want to do this anymore. But it was mostly, she was just stuck in those societal fears. And then a lot of other people get stuck in the, like, how do I actually make the quit? Which is really the simplest portion there. It's just say, hey, it's not you, it's me. Just like you would make a breakup, right? And just go, you hate everything about Acme Hospital. Don't go in and make it about Acme Hospital or your attending, whoever. Make it about you. And like, I'm feeling called to work at a rural hospital. I'm feeling called to try this other thing, so that if everything that you try outside of Acme doesn't work, the door's probably still open at Acme because you didn't badmouth anything about them. You just said, hey, I want to try these other things, right? And that's the easiest part. And so is, frankly, getting over the whole, what are other people going to think? Because what they're going to think is not much and not for very long. Like, we all have very distraction-filled worlds. So why would you let the possibility that somebody's going to think negatively about you, and P.S., they're probably going to think positively about you. They're probably really jealous that you're doing this thing. But on the off chance they have that, oh my gosh, you're a caregiver. Do you not want to care for people anymore? They're going to think about that for 5 minutes. They're going to go on with their lives, but you're the one stuck in the job. Mm. And so telling people, boom, like pointing
boom
out,
right? Boom. I like that. That's true. That's true. Okay.
Pointing out the balance sheet there of like the 3 seconds they may possibly think something negative about you, but weighed against the 80 hours a week you're miserable doing a thing, it just, the math is not in your favor to let that stop you.
I love that. Those are really, really good points. Let's transition a little bit. Let's pivot. We're getting towards the end of the interview. Let's do some really quick fast fire questions. I ask you something and you tell me what comes off the top of your head. You actually ever been doing that already? So let's make it happen. So if we can parse this podcast down to just one thing, like, what's the most important thing that you want people to take away from this podcast?
Quitting isn't a dirty word. Settling is.
Damn. You're just dropping these bombs. I think I'm going to keep this podcast going for like another hour. Because, like, seriously, I love it. I love you. Give me all these quotes. All right. Well, knowing what you know now, let's say you had the opportunity to go back and give yourself advice as a pre-med. What kind of advice would you give yourself?
I was never a pre-med. I mean,
Technically, yeah.
Yeah. I would say, oh, way to go that you're managing to pull off all of pre-med in 1 year. And though it was like the hardest 10 years of my life, I can't say that I would undo any of it. I mean, I'd love to have much of it back. But if I hadn't done medicine and done law and learned all these lessons, I couldn't be where I am today, helping spread this message that will help give other people the permission to live their best lives.
What is a personal habit that has helped you become more successful? Are you going to say quitting?
I was like, yeah, how many things can I use that as the answer?
You can use that as quitting a habit.
Oh my God, it's quitting is a habit and a drug. And it's a drug I have no plan on stopping. Like, when used properly, you know you've made the right quit, because the second you do it, or the second you even think about doing it, you feel better. The second you actually do it, you feel amazing. And it's just gotten me out of just time after time. I mean, I made a quit last night, make them all the time. Like my fitness trainer person wants me to like write down all my food intake for the day. And that was giving me a lot of stress. And it was making me starving all the time because I was feeling guilty about eating the food. And I was like, no, we're quitting this. This is not working for me. And I no longer have to sit around in these anxiety ridden states. Because as soon as anxiety pops up for me, I can reframe it and say, what's it trying to tell me? You know, I'm not anxious for no reason. And anxiety could be your biggest cross to bear, or it can be your best friend. And I've decided to make it my best friend. And that's been very helpful.
Great answer. Name a famous figure, if there is one, or someone that you admire, someone that you find inspirational, that you wouldn't mind trading places with just for 24 hours.
Tulsi Gabbard. Okay. Do you know who she is? She's running for president. Now, I don't want to run for president. Every time I say I want to be Tulsi Gabbard, that was pre-running for president. But she's a capoeirista. She's a surfer. She and her husband have no kids. I don't know if they're having any, but I want to have a husband and no kids. She can sing. They're both musicians. And she's a congresswoman from Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. She just announced a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. She's just all around, you know, and she's had some skeletons in her past. They all have. But her current life, she just is consistently so leading with love, as her little thing says. And she's just the nicest person and legit into election reform and all those things, I think, are incredible. So, yeah.
What's one life hack or technology that you're using that makes your life easier?
The Aura Ring, which, oh, I'm showing you and nobody else can see. I have this fitness tracker ring that helps me know exactly how much sleep I got at night, how much deep sleep, REM sleep, all those things. And then when I wake up, it not only tells me that, but it gives me this readiness score, which includes my body temperature, my heart rate variability, my resting heart rate for the night, shows me how, and it balances how much activity I did yesterday and the few days prior. And it gives me a readiness score that says either you're ready to go today and hit it hard at the gym, or maybe you should take some time off. And that has saved me from getting ill so many times, because I wake up and my body temperature is up and I'm like, my readiness is down, body temp's up. I'm not going to the gym. I'm going to sit around and take supplements all day and just be good to myself. And I just don't get sick. And that's really helpful. And so that's called the Aura, O-U-R-A. P.S. If you go to aurarring.com/partners/, that's quit. You'll get $50 off. No problem.
I was going to say, like, are they an affiliate link right there?
Yeah.
Boom, I love it. Okay, all right.
But you know, you asked, and we did not plan these questions ahead of time.
So. I love it. I love it. We will put the link in the show notes. See? Well, Dr. Morski, I want you to complete this sentence. I'm not just a doc. I am a
Guns N' Roses karaoke enthusiast / bass player / salsa dancer, Bollywood dancer, swing dancer, all kinds of dancer / person who loves to live life more than just work.
I love it. I love it. Dr. Lynn Marie Morski, thank you for coming on Docs Outside the Box. Listen, I think it's really important what you're doing, actually. You're actually destigmatizing things that can cause so much anxiety in people's lives. For you to kind of put yourself out through it, go through that process, and then in turn go back and teach people, I think is really important. So I just wanted to acknowledge you for the work that you're doing. I think you're doing great work. Keep it up. This was a great conversation, actually. I think a lot of people are going to learn a lot from you. They're going to laugh. They may even be like, damn, she like gets me, you know? But all ultimately, I think this was a great conversation. So thank you so much for coming on Docs Outside the Box.
I thoroughly enjoyed my time here. Thank you so much for having me.